Good evening, church. Thank you very much for being here tonight. It's good to see you again, and I'm glad that we get a little bit more time to study this week and to spend a little bit more time on our discussion of the spiritual disciplines. I've really enjoyed my time here the past few days and have been extremely blessed by your hospitality and by your encouragement as we talk about these lessons, and so thank you very much for that. And I'm just enjoying it, and I hope that it's been a good thing for you and that it will continue to be that tonight and tomorrow night. I hope that, as I said last night, that you got one of those study guides for this message as you were coming in. I really do think that in the grand scheme of what we're doing this week, that those are particularly helpful. You probably want something to reference again after all of this. And so I hope that you got one of those. If you didn't get one and you want a study guide to help you follow along, raise your hand and Charlie's got some of those that he can bring and make sure that everybody has a way to track together as we go through our material for tonight. We want Christian discipleship to be as deeply ingrained in us as the grain is woven into a piece of wood. And if the Christian experience and the Holy Scriptures teach us anything, it's that that is going to take some serious discipline. I think you've already seen that. You know, I think you've already seen that as we've talked about self-examination and fasting, that those are already two things that they take a good deal of discipline, of self-discipline, to really make yourself do something difficult. And I think that's going to be the case as well with what we talk about tonight and tomorrow night. We're talking about sacrifice and giving tonight, and tomorrow night we're going to talk about prayer. Both of those are activities that at times they can be really easy, but at other times they take a whole lot of self-discipline to do them the way that we ought to. Before we really even get into this one though tonight, and I really wanted to make sure to do this at some point this week, I want to take just a minute to pause from our discussion of the spiritual disciplines and just remind all of us why we're having this discussion in the first place. I don't mean to make it sound in doing these lessons this week as though these are the things that you have to do to be good enough to go to heaven. Because the reality is, if you read the New Testament, there is nothing you can do to be good enough to go to heaven. The reason that you can go to heaven is because of the grace of God in Jesus Christ. That's what earns salvation for us, if you want to put it in those terms of it being earned by anybody, it is by Him. But what these spiritual disciplines are for is making sure that when we know we're in Christ, and when we know that we're living with Him, that these are the things that help us to walk more closely with God in our salvation. Not to gain our salvation, but to make the most of that salvation. And that's really what we're talking about when we try to put all of these ideas to work in our lives. It's about making sure that the way we live is as pleasing to God as it can be. Not that we've just done barely enough to get in the door of heaven, but that we want to live with God, and we want to live with Him in a faithful and genuine way. And that's what these are really about. And so that, I think, helps us to understand why the topics like fasting and self-examination and confession and sacrifice and giving make sense for people who are saved in Jesus Christ. Now, the other two sessions up to this point, the other two disciplines, I've had some sort of introduction to get us there. Tonight I have so much material that I just don't really have any introductory material to start us there, so let's just dig straight into it, okay? When we talk about the topic of sacrifice and giving, let's just start as we have with the others, with noticing that this is taught in the Bible in a lot of places. In a lot of places and in some really powerful ways. And so we start with the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, you get demonstrations of this principle at work when God asks the people to tithe. This is something that you remember from the Old Testament that is built into the law of Moses, that in Deuteronomy 14, verse 22, you shall tithe all the yield of your seed that comes from the field year by year. Well, the word tithe actually is a noun. It means one-tenth. It means 10%. But the Lord used it as a verb because the people were to give and donate 10% of what they took in, what they produced every year to the tabernacle or the temple. When you move on, you find other ways that the Lord commands this of the people. So Leviticus chapter 19 is a passage that you probably remember where He tells them, when you mow your fields, when you harvest the grain, You don't cut all the way to the edge of the field. You don't cut all the way to the corner of the field. You leave those sections. Why? So that the poor of the land can come in and they can glean from those sections and they can find the food that they need. He says the same thing about when you gather the grapes from your vineyard or the olives from your olive grove, that whatever falls on the ground as you do that, leave it there. Why? So that the poor of the land can come in and you can give that to them to help them. And then when you get to the New Testament, and people are still living under the law of Moses even in the time of the New Testament, you have the story in Luke chapter 21 where Jesus sees the poor widow who puts in her 2 small copper coins. But before that story, before you even get to really the impact of that story, what you have there is a demonstration of people making contributions into the temple fund. And this is just another display of people who lived under the law of Moses, who made offerings and made contributions and gave in some way for the good of God's things and of His people. Now, that was the Old Testament. The same thing, though, is expected in the New Testament. There's plenty of places that we can look to see this. One of them what we referenced a couple of times already this week from Matthew chapter 6. In Matthew chapter 6, in the opening verses of that chapter, the Lord says there are 3 things there that when you do these things, this is how you should do them. He says, when you fast, we talked about that. When you pray, we'll talk about that tomorrow night. And when you give to the needy. Not if, but when you give to the needy. And then in Acts chapter 4, we find another demonstration of this. As the Christians, the early Christians, are living together in the city of Jerusalem, they all are there in the same place. Acts chapter 4, toward the end of that chapter, it tells us there was not a needy person among them, for as many as were owners of lands or houses sold them and brought the proceeds of what was sold and laid it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to each as any had need. In the Old Testament, they left the corners of the field unmowed. In the New Testament, they sold the field and they gave the money to help the people among them who were poor and needed something. And then we have the thing that most Bible translators will call the collection for the saints. In most of our Bibles, over 1 Corinthians chapter 16, it has that phrase in the subheadings there, the collection for the saints. And it's a collection that's talked about in the 1 Corinthian letter, in the 2 Corinthian letter, and in Acts chapter 11, and I believe also in the book of Galatians, where Paul is collecting funds from saints everywhere that he knows there are saints, and he's bringing those funds to help the brethren in the area of Judea who are living through a famine. And so again, what you have is a demonstration of people being generous with their money to help those who need it. And then there's a couple of examples of Paul being supported by people's contributions so that he can continue his work of evangelism. Why am I showing you all of that? Well, I'm showing you that so that you know that in what we talk about tonight, that we're going to get to some really just straightforward applications in a little while about how we're supposed to be doing this sort of thing. And I want us to start with the realization that when we make it a point to be sacrificial and giving for others, that we are not alone in doing this. This has always been an expectation of God's people. That in the way you live your life, He's laid out some guidelines and He's laid out some practical advice and some good wisdom on how you can make sure that you are giving for other people. Now, with all of those passages, I want to be clear about just a couple of things. And I don't believe these are in your study guide, so you may want to make a marginal note here. But I want to be clear on 2 things here, 2 realizations from all of these passages put together. First, in all of the cases that we just read about, what we're talking about there is giving in a way that is designed and meant to help others. Whether it was a donation to the temple in order to help the Levites, or it was leaving the corners of the field in order to help the poor, or it was selling your property and bringing the money to the apostles to help somebody in the church in Jerusalem. In all of those cases, it was about helping somebody else. Are you familiar with the word altruistic? Anybody know this word or altruism? It's one of those words that I had to look it up at one point because I found myself running across it so many different times and I realized I didn't really know what it meant. But basically what it boils down to is this definition. Somebody who is altruistic is unselfishly concerned for the welfare of others. That's what altruism is about. Now, what's interesting about that is all the different places where I found myself reading it, somebody is ridiculing the very idea of altruism, as though there is just, it's not possible that anybody would ever do something that isn't somehow self-serving, right? Because all of us, even when we do something good, why do we do it? We do it good for somebody else. Why do we do that? Well, the assumption is we always do it because we want something out of it. It's greedy in some way. But you know what? For all the people that make fun of that idea, that ridicule the very idea of altruism, isn't that exactly what Christians are called to be? Aren't we called to be exactly that, to be altruistic? That, yeah, there may be good in it for us, but that's never why we're motivated to help somebody else. Our motivation is for the good of that person. And so when we talk about this, this is what all of these passages demonstrate, is that we are talking about altruistic good just for the sake of somebody else. And then second realization from all these passages is that while there will be times when an opportunity to give comes up out of nowhere, what I want to show you tonight is that it ought to be a habit for us, that we make it a habit of giving to other people. And that's how this functions in our set of lessons about the spiritual disciplines. We want to make it something that we do regularly. Now, I know that's going to take different forms for different people, and we'll talk about that toward the end of the message, so I understand that right now. But it's kind of like we said about fasting, right? You get to decide how you're going to do it and when you're going to do it and to what level you're going to do it, but you don't get to decide if you're going to do this. You can decide how, when, and how much, but you don't get to decide if. Because this is one of the ideas that's just a part of how we live for our God. And so, that said, it will be good for you when you do good for other people. And I don't want that to be the primary motivator here, but with the biblical precedent set that this is about helping other people, let's talk for just a second about how sacrifice and giving are good for the soul. Like all the others that we have talked about so far, and we haven't really stated this directly, but when you think about it, with fasting, there's no necessarily tangible benefit that comes to you. It's the strength of your soul that you're after in that activity. And with self-examination, there's not necessarily a tangible, you know, monetary or physical benefit that's going to come from doing that, but it's the good that it does for your soul. And the same is going to be true here. You're not going to be able to measure the success of your efforts in sacrifice and giving by looking at your calendar or your bank statement. It's just not going to work like that. But what you will be able to do is tell that there are some real consequences and real blessings that come from this. First one, here's three of these here. First, it increases our appreciation of God's generosity toward us. Now, I need to make sure that we keep in mind in this discussion that we are talking tonight about sacrifice and giving, about sacrifice. And so we should not expect, when we think about this, to find things that we can do that cost us nothing. You remember that passage where David is going to offer a sacrifice to the Lord, and somebody offers to give him the animal and build the altar for him and make all of this possible so that the king can offer his sacrifice. And David says, I will not offer that to the Lord which costs me nothing. There's a really powerful principle in that statement, that we will not offer to somebody else that which costs us nothing. We need to understand right on the front end here that we are going to be doing something that costs us. And doing that will help us, I think, to understand a little better the depths of God's generosity toward us. Because in the things that He has given you, yeah, I know it would be easy to look around and go, well, God doesn't have any less money because I have more. God doesn't have any less food because I have more. But I would remind you that God sacrificed His Son for you. And when you stop to consider that, when you make a sacrifice for the good of somebody else, and then realize that your sacrifice pales in comparison to the sacrifice He has made for you, it helps you to understand how generous and how good God really is. It's kind of like the realization that I think most of us have had, if we have kids, that your parents did a whole lot more for you than you were aware of at the time. Those of us who had good godly parents, Sometimes we get frustrated at with them because we feel like you're not doing enough for me. You're not doing what you need from me. But then about as soon as you have kids, you start looking back and going, oh, there was more to that than I realized. As soon as you start to deal with just the simple things like the frustration of a toddler who won't sit still in church, right? You start to realize the sacrifices and the generosity of your parents' patience towards you as a kid. And this is the same way that when we start to give as God has given to us, it helps us to understand, at least in some small way, how deep His generosity really runs. And so this is one of the blessings that will definitely come when we make it a practice of being giving, generous people. Second blessing here is that it will increase our concern for our fellow man. I get a weekly email devotion from a religious teacher in Louisville, and I'd just like to read to you a section from that one of those devotions. This particular writer was talking about Leviticus 19, the passage about not cutting the corners of the field. And this is what was said. Leviticus 19:2 commands that you shall be holy, and the remaining verses outline what this means, namely, leave the corners of your fields for those who are hungry. Do not defraud your neighbor. Do not withhold wages from a laborer. Do not stand by idly while your neighbor bleeds. Do not curse a deaf person or put a stumbling block before one who is blind. A judge should not show a preference for the rich at the expense of the poor. Love your neighbor as yourself and treat the stranger amongst you as if they had been born amongst you. They continue, biblical laws, like standing by while our neighbor bleeds, speak to the profound spiritual danger of apathy. You know, there's a lot of good wisdom in that right there. That when we are apathetic toward other people, we are not living as our Father in heaven. Because He is never apathetic toward anybody. He loves humanity. And He shows His goodness in every way. And so making a habit of being good in an altruistic, selfless kind of way, never hoping for a reward and never expecting to be paid back, that kind of compassion fights apathy and it helps us to love our fellow man in the way God would love them. And this is good as well, this whole idea of sacrifice and giving, because it strips away the distractions that we face when we try to live for God. There's a quote that I love, and there's a writer that I love. His name is A.W. Tozer, and this quote from him is one of my favorites. I'm going to put it here on the screen for you in its entirety. It's a bit long, but bear with me, it's worth it. Tozer says, "The man who has God for his treasure has all things in one. Many ordinary treasures may be denied him, or if he is allowed to have them, the enjoyment of them will be so tempered that they will never be necessary to his happiness. Or if he must see them go one after one, he will scarcely feel a sense of loss. For, having the source of all things, he has in one all satisfaction, all pleasure, all delight. Whatever he may lose, he has actually lost nothing. For he now has them all in one, and he has it purely, legitimately, and forever." That is a beautiful sentiment that is so hard to live out. Because this is what we want. This is what the Apostle Paul said. He said, "Whatever gain I had, I counted as loss for the sake of knowing Jesus Christ." It's the same idea here as in this quote. That what we're really about is knowing God. And when we are generous with the things that God has given to us, when we are willing to be open-handed with His blessings and pass them on to others, it reminds us that we don't need those blessings from God. What we need is God. Now, His blessings will always come, but what we really need is Him. And so, kind of in the same way that we talked about with fasting, we never really know what we're missing when we always have everything we want. It's interesting to me. The Bible has no prohibition on being rich. It has no cap on how rich is too rich for a Christian. But it tells us over and over again that being rich, while it may be permissible, is not always healthy. It's just not always a good thing for us to have everything we need all of the time. And so giving things away, sacrificing things that are precious to us, That helps us, I think, to see a little more clearly what was truly helpful and what wasn't always helpful. There are some things in our life that are lawful to have, but they are not helpful for us to have. It's kind of like a rich young man who came to Jesus one time, and he asked Jesus, "What do I need to do to inherit the kingdom?" And he said, "Sell everything you have, give it to the poor, and then come and follow me." I know most of the time that I hear preachers reference that passage, the first words out of their mouth are, "Now Jesus doesn't command that of us." But you know what? I think in some cases, maybe exactly what he commands of us. That what we do is we take the blessings we have and we give them to the poor because they're distracting us from focusing on God Himself. And that's hard. That young man went away sorrowful because he had great possessions. And many of us, when we see this kind of thing, we will tend to do the same thing. It's a hard thing. It's a hard piece of advice to take seriously, a hard piece of expectations from God to put to work. But I would remind you that when we talk about this, God is not asking us to do anything more than what He Himself has already been willing to do. He's not asking us for any more than what He has been willing to do in making sacrifices and being generous to us. And so that's why, I want to talk about that directly for just a second. You could probably call this the theology of this spiritual discipline if you wanted another title for this section of the message. Because this is where we think about what God is really like in this discussion. God describes Himself in the Bible as a king. And see, we live in a society where we really don't care for kings, right? Our whole country came to exist out of rebellion against a king. We don't really like that idea in this country. We're not brought up to respect that idea. But when you read about God as the king, you're reading about a truly unique king, aren't you? A very good king. In fact, he is what many people have described as a benevolent dictator. Now, what does that mean? That means that he is, yes, a dictator. He is sovereign. He has all power and can be the only ruler. But he is a benevolent dictator. And what that means is that he is a king who can truly and perfectly always put the good of his citizens first. Now, if we could trust a human to do that when he sat on a throne, we would really be sitting pretty, you know? If we had a king who could truly do that, who was not self-serving in any way at all, but was all about the good of his citizens, that would be the ideal form of government. I don't trust any human to do that, certainly not myself and not anybody I know. But I trust God with that, because that's what He has always been. He is always one who, far from enslaving people, has given freedom to His people. Because that's what He does, because He is a giver of good things. Now again, as I say, that would be a miraculous accomplishment for any man to live as a truly righteous, benevolent dictator. But while it would be a miracle for us, it's what God does all of the time. That's not just God on a good day, that's who He is. He is a benevolent dictator. And in that aspect of His nature, we see the importance and the power, I think, of our own practices of sacrifice and giving. Because the benevolent dictator whom we serve, he's not only good to those who have deserved his goodness, because if he was that, then no one would deserve his goodness, but he is good to all people. And so we find this from Luke chapter 6. These beginning words, I think, are familiar as Jesus tells us to love our enemies. But listen closely to the rest of this. He says, "Love your enemies, and do good, and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great. And you will be sons of the Most High, for He is kind," listen to who He is kind to "the ungrateful and to the evil." The ultimate expression of sacrifice and giving, and Jimmy mentioned this in his prayer a little while ago, is the cross of Jesus Christ. And the book of Romans tells us that the cross was a gift not for people who were good, because scarcely for a good man would a person dare to die. But the cross of Jesus Christ was a gift that was so remarkable Because He gave that gift while we were still sinners. That is the ultimate good of this great God. And that's why it's important for us to be sacrificial and giving people, generous people. Because we're told to be perfect as our Heavenly Father is perfect. And in the very context where Jesus said that, where He said, be perfect for your Father is perfect, in that exact same context, He says, God makes His sun rise on the evil and on the good. He sends rain on the just and the unjust. You, therefore, must be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect. And so, I'll be perfectly honest, this is one of those things I don't really even love to talk about this because it reminds me how selfish I am. But this is one of those things where we look to God and we see the ultimate example of somebody whose hand is open with all the blessings that He can give. And so what we want to do is try to live like that. And that means that we have a pretty hard task ahead of us. And so that kind of begs the question then, how are we going to do this? How are we going to put this to work in our lives and be the kind of people who are sacrificial and generous in the ways that we should? I want to use the rest of my time to give you some practical tips. And as you can see from the study guide, I think there are 7 of these that we're going to go through. But I want to just take for a second here, I want to take a break from that study guide. And can I ask for your very careful attention for just a second? Because there's a little caveat that I want to throw in before we get into the discussion of how we can put all of this to work. I'm going to go ahead and admit right here that this is going to be the trickiest part of the discussion tonight, this last section of actually doing this. And here's why. In the churches where I have grown up, I've heard a lot of sermons, and many of you probably have too, on the difference between the works of the church treasury and the works of an individual's money. And so along with that, there was a good amount of teaching that I heard growing up on whether we can give to organizations that are associated with churches or whether we should not do that. Now, tonight's message is not the place for us to have that discussion, and so we're not going to. But I will say this, that for those of us who have firm convictions about such things, and those convictions are based on our study of the Word of God, we're probably going to have to work a little bit harder to find ways to fulfill this divine mandate than people who don't share those same convictions in the way that we find the Scriptures to teach them. When we talk about actually doing sacrifice and giving, there are ways that it can be done in harmony with the convictions about works of the church and works of the individual. There are ways that it can be done in that way. And we really, brothers and sisters, need to be committed to finding the ways to do this work. Because here's what has happened, at least in my experience, limited though it may be, and I understand that, but here's what I've seen happen. For those of us who hold firmly to the teachings, again, about the works of the church treasury or the works of an individual, for those of us who hold firmly to those teachings and are diligent in remaining faithful to those ideas, in all of their diligence to remain faithful to those ideas, there have been some who have said, well, if I can't do it through those organizations, then I guess I don't have to do anything at all. That is not the biblical teaching. And frankly, brothers and sisters, that rationale is no longer acceptable. If that's what you've been operating on as a premise, I'm telling you to stop. It's just not okay. Because in our caution to not do anything wrong, many of us have ended up not doing is anything. And that's not okay. And so if you grew up, and the way the Bible is written explains this perfectly. It's one of those things that's just so obvious and so important for us to remember, but we forget about it. Because if you grew up hearing the King James Version being used in church services, then you probably remember 1 Corinthians 13 a little bit differently than most people read it today. Because in most modern versions it says, love does not envy, love is not arrogant, you know, love does not seek its own, those sort of things. But in the King James Version it says, charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself, doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own. Charity never faileth. Now, what do we mean when we use that word charity? Well, we mean an organization that is a charity. Or we mean an act that is of a charitable nature, where you give to somebody else. And I wondered a handful of months ago, why is it that word? I mean, the King James Version, they could have used the word love. They used it in other places. Why did they use the word charity right there? And so I went and looked it up. And the word, that as we use it, comes from the Old English. And it meant for them benevolence for the poor, exactly as it does to us. But here's what I thought was really interesting about it. The word charity comes from the French, in which it was just still the word charity, spelled a little differently, but pronounced the same. But it comes from the French, and in French, that word meant Christian. In French, the word that we use now to describe an act of generosity was so linked in their minds to Christians and the way they behaved that what they came to use as the word for doing good was the word Christian. Brothers and sisters, they recognized centuries ago that this is who we are. If we are the people of God, that this is what we're supposed to be about. And so keep your convictions and maintain those convictions about how you will be generous. But be generous as God's people, because this is so important for how we live. And so that's why I want to give you some practical pieces of advice on how do we do this, okay? So that with that caveat set, and we can all understand that this is something we should do. With that caveat set, let me give you 7 super quick things to help us make this a part of our spiritually disciplined life with God. Okay, here's the first one. Number one, start at home. You want to talk about sacrifice and giving and being a generous person, then start at home. Don't get grandiose ambitions about changing whole countries on the other side of the world and then find yourself neglecting to give for your kids and for your spouse and for your parents. Don't do that. And if you want a couple of Bible passages to back up that advice, take a look at Ephesians chapter 5. As the apostle there talks about being a generous person and a kind person towards your spouse in the same way that God is kind toward His church. And then if you want to talk about making sure that we're generous toward our parents, go to Matthew chapter 15 and to 1 Timothy chapter 5. I'll leave you to read Matthew on your own. But let me highlight the idea real quickly from 1 Timothy chapter 5. Just remind us that the idea of us caring for our parents, especially as they age and they need us more, the idea of caring for our parents is so important to the Apostle Paul that he puts it nearly on the same level with discipleship itself. That if a person will not care for his own, he has denied the faith and he's worse than an unbeliever. It's that important to the inspired apostle that we care for those who are close to home. And so again, don't get grandiose ambitions about changing the economic structure of a desert-laden third world continent and then forget to be generous to the people who live in your house. And then secondly, right on the heels of that, if you want to be a sacrificial and giving and generous person, look to your own community. And this is another version of the same idea there, that we start close to home. If you're planning some sort of overseas evangelism trip or some sort of, you know, beneficial type thing in some other place, that's fine. Keep doing that. But make sure that while you're doing that, you're doing evangelism and generous work here in Danville and in the counties around here. Make sure that what you're doing starts with where you are. If you're looking to give to the poor or to help orphans and widows and sojourners, then look for ways to do that in your own community, because you will find those. And you can do God's work right here. And then thirdly, I just mentioned a few of these, look for the groups that the Bible specifically mentions and look for ways that you can help those groups. The Bible talks about religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father, being that we visit orphans and widows in their distress. Look for ways that you can help those groups, the orphans and the widows. The Scriptures talk about, again, leaving the corners of the field. Why? For the poor among the land. Jesus talks about, in one particular place, He says, the poor you will have with you always. And I think sometimes we can kind of hear that as like a little wave of the hand. He goes, listen, don't worry about him. You'll always have the poor. No, he doesn't mean that. That's not who Jesus is. What he means is you will help the poor at some point because you'll always have that opportunity to do that. Look for those who are sojourners, who are not able to be at home for some reason or another, and help them while they are stuck away from home. All of that is just ways that we can look for the places that and the ways and the groups that the Bible actually talks about us helping, and then we help those people. All right, so that's three pieces. Number four here, the middle one in the bunch. Number four, put sacrifice and giving in the budget. Put it in your budget to do some sort of good work for the people around you. At one of the big evangelical churches in Louisville, I listened to their preacher on occasion, and he did a series a couple years ago called What's in Your Wallet? And he said, I've never gotten more emails from people in my church saying that I shouldn't have preached something, because he said, it's just not the church's business to be telling me how I'm supposed to use my money. Now, you're more mature, I think, than the people who must have been sending those emails, because you know, as well as I do, that if you're going to be mad at a preacher for telling you how you should and shouldn't use your money, the preacher you need to be mad at is named Jesus, because he talks quite a bit about how our money should and should not be used. And one of the things that he says about that is that on the judgment day, there will be people who stand before God and who say to him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king will answer them, truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these my brothers, you did it to me. Well, how are you going to do that? You're going to have to make some plans for doing that. You need to put some money aside in the budget that you can use for good things. Because those things that Jesus is talking about there, food, clothing, shelter, those cost money. And you're going to have to put some money aside to make sure that you can be a person who gives that for other people. And so if I, just as practically as I can here, if I can encourage you with this, I suggest that you choose a certain number of dollars or a certain percentage amount of your income from whatever source it comes from that you commit to using for the good of others, and that you commit not to allow yourself to use that selfishly. I just suggest that you make it a point, that you decide this is going to be our definite plan for being sacrificial and giving people. Now, in putting it in the budget, that makes it sound like it's only a monetary thing. This whole discussion is only about money, and it is largely about money. But it's not only that, and so that's the fifth one here in the list, is make sure that you give more than money. You can volunteer your time. You can be a mentor in some way. You can adopt. You can be a foster parent. There's so many different ways that you can give more than money in order to make sure that you care about some other people. Some people just want a conversation, and I learned this firsthand about a year ago. I pulled up to the church building one Thursday morning, just like I normally do. I pulled up, swung around the side of the building, went to my normal parking spot, and as I came around the corner of our building, there was an old beat-up Nissan Sentra parked in our parking lot, and I could tell immediately there was somebody not only in that car but living in that car. And so, you know, you spend time very much at a church building during the daylight hours, and especially if you're on a main road as we are at our building, you kind of expect certain types of things. If somebody comes up to the building unannounced, usually they're going to have some convoluted story, and you're going to test it, and you're going to find that there's all kinds of holes in it, and they want some money. And so you kind of train yourself to, you know, just be ready that I'm not going to get an honest person here. Oh, I know that. I'm kind of used to that. I kind of am a little bit jaded, admittedly, to these kind of situations. But I still try to resist that temptation and give everybody a fair hearing when I get the opportunity to do that. And so this particular day, I pulled up. I got out of my car. And as I got out of my car, this man was getting out of his. A disheveled-looking older man. Looked like he hadn't had a shower in a good long time. Looked like he had really been, you know, living a pretty hard life for the past little while in his life. And as he came across the parking lot, I said, friend, what can I do for you? And he said, can I just have a cup of coffee and somebody to talk to for a little bit? I've been alone for a long time, and I'd just like to talk to somebody. And I said, yeah, I'd be more than happy to give you that and a whole lot more. Because that was somebody that needed more than money. What that person needed was a connection. He needed somebody to care about him. And you're going to find people in your life like that too. That's what they need. They don't need money. Matter of fact, sometimes that may be the last thing they need. But they need you in some way. And so find ways that you can give more than money. Number 6 out of 7 in this list is make it a habit. I'm not going to spend much time on that. I just want to encourage you. Make this something regular, that you have a way that you do this frequently and routinely. And then one more piece of advice in regard to all of this. Number 7 here, don't try to do everything, but at least plan to do something. Listen, there is only one benevolent dictator who can meet all the needs of all people all the time. He sits on the throne of heaven. You're not going to take his spot, okay? So don't try to do everything all the time. But don't let the fact that you can't do everything stop you from doing something. Don't let that happen. Start close to home. Give yourself a clear understanding of what your priorities should be. And make it a point to do something generous for the people around you. Jesus admonished all generations with these wonderful words from the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 through 21. He said, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." One of the ways that you can lay up treasure in heaven is by being generous with the treasures that God has given you here on earth. And I want to encourage you to make that a habit, to make it one of the spiritual disciplines that governs your life and that leads you to greater faithfulness toward God. If there's somebody tonight that has a spiritual need that you want to make known in a public way, we'd love to give you an opportunity to do that. You can talk to me, to BJ, to one of the shepherds of this congregation, and we'll open the Word of God and show you what it says about coming to Him and living with Him through this life and the next one. So if you want to do that, I'd love for you to come and talk to us while we stand and sing this hymn together.